Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Today, family estrangement. Joining us, psychiatrist Mark Whaley and psychiatrist Jonathan Schwartz. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Morning.
So lots of reasons one might want to cut off a family member, right? And this could be a parent and a child, the siblings. And most often, what do they say? It's a toxic environment or a toxic parent. And this could be anything from some kind of abuse to misunderstandings. I mean, there's a whole range of reasons, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, something has hurt the individual who wants to initiate the cut. Or at least to put boundaries around the other individual. Something has hurt them. And the only way they feel, at least at that point in time, that they can right the wrong or assert themselves and or some other time get even, so to speak, is to isolate the offender from any involvement in their life. You know, it's all a matter of perception, and people perceive things according to how they project into them, really, how they make meaning out of what goes on. And the meaning is their own and not necessarily shared. And that's the problem. There really isn't a sharing of people being seen as how they are, the pair, say, the child and the parent, neither of them see each other as really they are, and that hurts. Mm-hmm. So the big blow up, the only way you can sort of calm the flames is to walk away and be away. So that's the slang term for this, although it's probably in the professional lexicon now, is parentectomy, like it's a surgery. Remove the parent, the offending organ from your body.
I think that as mental health professionals, as therapists, it doesn't come easily to us to endorse or encourage or support this kind of surgical intervention, as Mark mm-hmm. refers to it, which it is. Of course, it's not only the parents who sometimes need to be put at a distance. Sometimes for parents, it's the child who needs to be put at a distance, especially mm-hmm. In the world of substance in addiction. It mm-hmm. can be really very difficult. But I think, Mark and I have both been doctors for a long, long time. And still, it's not really what we went to school. We try to heal people, right? We try to make things better. We try to find some kind of trick or way in to make things better, to bring people together where there's a long history of pain and suffering and what appears to be hostility or aggression. But sometimes it just does not appear, there does not appear to be any way to preserve one's sanity other than to have a separation.
Yeah. And that's what I was thinking about, too, is, thoughts on discussion about this, because, I've read and I've heard stories from someone who has been cut off, doesn't understand what happened or why. And the person, that's cut them off, it's like we're done. Like, there's no mm-hmm. conversation. And I can imagine that would be really hard. Maybe one thing if somebody said, OK, well, here's why. And you go, mm-hmm. OK, but to mm-hmm. not even know why. Mm-hmm. someone that you love is cutting you out of their life. Sure. I can imagine that would be like extremely difficult.
Sure. Well, that's where it's used as a weapon. To really kind of get back at the offender is to limit them from like seeing the grandchildren,
right.
For instance. It's used as a weapon there because the child feels helpless. They don't have any other way to get the parent's attention. And what the parent focuses on is, I don't know why, as if they're ignorant. as if they haven't been living, their life as long as they have with the other person. They need to know why. They need to know why, but they need to know themselves why. And it, just being told is not the problem. The fact that they don't know is what breeds this kind of blow up. They could know. They could put themselves in the child, if it happens to be that way, child's shoes and see. But even then, sometimes it's better just to go your separate ways. The patterns get to be so ingrained strike and hurt and strike and hurt.
Yeah, it's kind of like I'm with you guys. I'm kind of like, let's get everybody in therapy. I don't right. see, but it comes back to what you were saying about perception, right? What started this conversation was an article that we all saw in the New York Times about family estrangement. And the thing that struck me was there was, I think it was an 18-year-old, I can't remember if it was a boy or girl, who cut off the father because the father, this teenager, I think it was a girl, felt the father favored the boy in the family and didn't give her enough attention. And the father was like, what? Like, it was a complete shock to him because he thought he had paid attention. So that whole perception thing, and if you can't talk about it and have conversations about it, that's going to lead you down a really dark path.
Yeah, it's painful. Very, very painful for both parties. Even with that height of hostility and need for defending oneself, it's only words and it's only feelings, and feelings and words are temporary and life is short when you really look at it from afar. And do you really want to live your life in this battle? Can't there be some things that you can agree on, or not just agree on, but see it from the other person's point of view? That's where you really ought to move your attention. That's the challenge.
Yeah.
I mean, Mindy, I think you make a point about people, parents who have been cut off from their kids, who don't even know. I recently, we had two patients come to us for TMS, for depression, chronic depression, not well related, but not entirely about that parentectomy. And neither of these women, they said over and over again to me in conversation that they had no idea why their children, their child, or actually in both cases, actually it was multiple children, would have nothing to do with them. And we see that particularly people expressing a lot of pain around being separated or cut off from their grandchildren, right? Because their adult child has cut them off, and they know perfectly well that there are grandchildren there that they have seen in the past and can't have no access to now. It's hard to even know what to say.
Yeah. And these estrangements can be temporary or permanent. And I'm wondering your thoughts on, instead of, this separation, about setting boundaries before making a decision of cutting somebody off completely. And I think I've got an example in my own life. My mother was an alcoholic. And as a kid, you can't go anywhere. You're sort of stuck. But once I became an adult, and she was a very intelligent woman. And when she was sober, she understood, my position, and she would be very apologetic for it. So it was, I don't want to talk to you when you're drunk. So don't call me, don't come to my house. And if you do, I'm going to hang up on you. And maybe a couple times she broke the rules and I would hang up on her. But she knew I meant it and she followed the rules. So I didn't have to, cut her out of my life. I just had to cut that part of her out of my life. I imagine there are, we could have that conversation, but I imagine there are situations where it's very difficult to have that kind of conversation with your parent, right? But what about setting boundaries?
That should be the first step. Really, or if it's to a point where you need to set a boundary as opposed to talk out the problem right from the start. And with substance abuse, denial is the name of the game, at least from the the abuser's point of view. So until they can weaken that a little bit or modify that a little bit, they're going to be having trouble with alcohol, and it's going to kill them. Of course, it does. You're doing them a favor, really, if you're setting some boundaries, because it's getting their attention to what is bringing their attention. They can't ignore it. It's one thing they can't deny is that they don't have a connection with their child, and the reason is the bottle that came in between them. The bottle is the person is relating. The bottle becomes more important than the person that is setting the boundaries, and that as a victim of that, it's a horrible experience, and until that the substance abuser can appreciate that and see what they've done, they'll continue with their addiction. I mean, AA is full of stories about that, and real life experiences, and it's when the abuser can start looking at the destructiveness of their relationship with alcohol, that they can start to get sober, which is, certainly a favor for them to set the boundaries. So they might have an opportunity to do that.
Jonathan, what about setting boundaries when you have like mental illness as you know, one of the reasons, like you have a narcissistic parent or, there's just something else. I don't know what, but, what would those boundaries be? How would you deal with that? I mean, it might be difficult for that parent to even understand what you're talking about.
Of course.
I'm sorry, I didn't catch the first part of
No, I
that.
just wondered about setting boundaries. We were talking about, when you're like with my mother who was an alcoholic, I could have a conversation with her about it when she was sober. But if you have a parent with some sort of mental illness, you might not be able to have that conversation. So what are your thoughts on how you set boundaries in a situation like that?
I think unless the parent has a serious cognitive problem like dementia, I think even for people who have, significant illnesses like bipolar disorder or schizophrenia, and so on, I think you can have those conversations. I think what's most challenging about it is having those conversations in a kind of calm, in a calm way, which doesn't, very quickly blow up. I think that that what's most difficult isn't really with having those conversations with folks with what we would call, serious or severe mental illness. It's more difficult when you have a parent with a personality disorder, and there are parents, of course, because there are people who may be like very narcissistic, for example, or borderline, who just won't engage in any kind of dialogue in which you can end up feeling that you were heard.
That's right.
Right? I mean, and if you know the solution to that, please let me
Yeah, that would be one of those situations where you have no choice but to separate. 866-999-4626 is our number. If you'd like to join our conversation this morning, you have a suggestion or a story you'd like to share, 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll have more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking about family estrangement this morning with psychiatrist Mark Whaley and psychiatrist Jonathan Schwartz. Perhaps you found a way to reconcile. We'd love to hear how you did that. 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. So a family estrangement doesn't just impact the two people that are no longer in contact with each other. This has so much, wider impact in the whole family, right? I'm thinking of a couple of examples. One is you got the parent and the son or daughter. What about mom, right? And then, it creates all kinds of problems.
That's right, and again, it gets back to that perception problem. There's one scenario I've seen for a number of times over the years of being a psychiatrist, and that is the person with major mental illness, like schizophrenia, and they don't believe they're ill, and they refuse medication. And the family is torn apart because they try to protect them. They don't want to have them out on the street where they know they're subject to harm. But at the same time, they pull their hair out because they know, and they've had experience in past history, that if the person gets on medicine, they become a different person. They can then appreciate reality or test reality like everybody else does. But unless they get on medication and stay on it, even though the person themselves doesn't like the effects of medication. There are some bad effects, no doubt, but the bad effects are very, they're a cheap price to pay for being sane, for not losing your mind. But they won't do it. And I've done some legal work, criminal legal work where there's been a murder, and the history is the person refused medication, and the mother who is trying to protect them is now deceased, because at the hands of their son. So it doesn't get much worse than that in terms of harm from having a different perception of reality, and the refusal, the denial of the person to take care of themselves as they should. There have been attempts of having laws work, but we don't have them in Massachusetts really, that are operational enough. So it's still up in the air. There's a conflict between civil rights and my body is my body, and I don't want foreign chemicals in it, and a mental illness that interferes with their perception of really what's going on, and they may as well have dementia because they can't get through, they can't connect the facts and reality.
That sounds like a really
It's
tough situation.
oh yeah yeah
Also thinking too, and this happens a lot, I'm sure, with siblings, right? Siblings decide, all right, I'm done with
yeah.
with my brother or my sister, and then poor mom and dad, it's like, well, I'm not coming to Christmas if you're inviting her, right?
That's right.
It's
That's
like
right.
just such, I mean, such trauma. So I think that's something we sort of need to keep in mind, right? If we're going to cut off a family member, is what are the, how does that impact your relationships with the rest of the family?
What are the costs, right? They're painful. They're all painful.
For
But
everybody.
sometimes the person who does the cutting or the isolating, they feel that their survival is at stake unless they make this move. Certainly, you try boundaries first, and discussion
And see how,
first, and first and last, and throughout, because there's nothing that
Well,
really can
you
be.
mentioned like it's trying to get the attention, and like maybe you've tried, and this is the only way you can do is just to cut them out, and then they go, wait a minute, what do you mean you're cutting me out? So then maybe you can come back to how about boundaries instead of, complete
Exactly.
estrangement.
Exactly. Yeah, good. Yeah, you want to keep the tie, but put limits on the assault of behavior or the toxic behavior.
All right, let's talk to Maria, who's giving us a call from Brewster. Hi, Maria.
Hi, I'm a little late to the party and the conversation, but I've experienced this and I've lovingly detached from a sibling who I've come to think that she has narcissistic personality disorder and was and it just has a like a really cruel soul and has had a horrible impact on me all my life. And I tried to please her and tried if I was good, maybe she'd change, and it just never changed. And now 50 years in, I just can't do it. So I've just loving I you know my goal is to just lovingly detach so we can have dialogue, but I'm not interested. She's toxic for me. She's unsafe for me, and I've done some terrible behavior to myself as a result of it because I just was so ashamed of my feelings for so many years. And so I think we don't really talk about the survivor or narcissism because everything I read about narcissism says they really can't hear feedback. And she would gaslight me, and she would flip it on herself. Yeah. So what are your thoughts on that? I mean, it's very painful. This is very painful
for
the survivors to deal with someone who's I feel like I finally acknowledged I've had trauma from it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And people, I'm sure people judge me and my family and think I'm terrible, but I can't do it anymore.
Yeah, sometimes you got to do what you got to do. Maria, I love how you said lovingly detached. I mean, that's, you know, you've really given a lot of thought to it. And Jonathan, you talked about this a minute ago, you know, with somebody who's narcissistic, they're not going to hear you. You're not going to feel heard, right?
Yeah, it's really, you know, it's so much feels like mourning the passing of somebody, right? It feels, it's often said quite rightly that when somebody passes away that you have had a very conflicted relationship with, it's particularly tough because at that point now you know you'll never have a chance to find a reconciliation or some kind of way back. And I think when you cut somebody off out of a complete feeling of frustration and hopelessness about it, it can feel very much like that. But what I find interesting about, is it Mary or Maria's talk is, you know, that feeling guilty and like you've done something wrong, mm-hmm. Which probably people who know you and who know the dynamics of the relationship would be very reassuring to you and say, you have nothing to feel guilty about. It's obviously not something I can personally, you know, say to you because I don't know you, but I think that must be very much part of why it's so hard to do it is feeling like you had no choice, but it still feels terrible.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Maria, good luck. Best of luck to you. Thank you for sharing your story.
Yeah, I would want to say that it's courageous of her to finally take the step. Mm-hmm. 50 years is a long time to be beaten up.
And clearly she's given it so much thought. I love that she said she did this lovingly. So she's not doing it out of any, you know.
That's right. She's not striking back.
Yeah. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. All right. So picking sides is never a fun place to be, right? And if you've got this, you know, you're mad at dad, I'm not going to have anything to do with dad, but I still want to talk to mom. And now mom's going to be put in the middle. And it's like, well, you're taking his side and you're not supporting me. That's another part of this. And that kind of plays into something a little bit different than estrangement, which is parental alienation. Mark, talk a little bit about what that is.
Yeah. Well, basically, it's I guess you could say one step short of being cut out completely. It's just not being included in the life of the family, except for maybe mandatory holidays or something like that. It's putting limits on the individual, this happens when one parent manipulates a child to reject the other. Sometimes parents are like that. They're like Trump, you know. They like a lot of fighting in their environment and contests in the family, whatever. This frequently happens in custody situations. They're trying to estrange the other and other parent from being close with their child. This is where it really is used as a weapon and a continuation of an abusive marriage.
Yeah,
really.
That's so sad when you see that. Like, you know, when there's a separation of a marriage and your one parent is using the kids against another parent. I'm not obviously not really thinking about the impact it has on the kids, right? I mean, that's a terrible position to be in.
Yeah, it doesn't matter, and that's where they're failing as a parent, really, when they're doing that.
And of course, then the kids grow up, and you know everything comes to light at some point, right? And that's going to be a real problem for the parent doing the alienating when the child grows up and says, I believed you all this time, right?
That's right.
Yeah. Thoughts, Jonathan, on that?
Well, I was just thinking about what happens sometimes. When the family, a person's family has been a source of a great deal of pain, and then they marry into a family that's more like that Leave It to Beaver kind of family, and they feel welcomed, and they have this, you know, or they're exposed to warmth and positive reinforcement, and that makes it possible for them, perhaps, you know, to separate from their family of origin that has been so conflicted. That's an especially difficult one for anybody to come back from, right? Because the person really has found refuge in their new family.
Yeah.
Again, I've been on the other side of that as a psychiatrist, a person who has lost contact with their child, who has now bonded with their in-laws and other family. And so when it comes to holidays, there's no question about, you know, where people are going to go to celebrate Christmas. I always recommend, of course, you know, becoming Jewish, because that's less of a problem. But, so far, I'm not aware of anybody taking me up on it for that reason.
Yeah, I think it's just, it's really tough. And then, you know, you think about somebody, if you've had a lot of trauma as a child, and, you know, then you grow up and you say, okay, I'm separating, I'm not going to do this anymore. And then maybe the parent that you had all this trauma with comes back and goes, guess what? I'm better now. You know, I'm no longer an alcoholic, or I'm no longer, you know, the person I was once was, and they want to come back into your life. What are your thoughts on, you know, you're going to be skeptical, that's for sure, right? So what are your thoughts on reconciliation? You know, what are some of the ground rules that you would recommend people think about?
That's what they ought to think about first. What are the ground rules of this reintroduction? Because trust has been broken. And the only way you can have a relationship is if there is a foundation of trust, and that has to be rebuilt. You know, just the extruded parent can't just say, I want this and I'm different. He has to really show it, or she has to really show it. To be genuine about it. So, you know, that takes time. Mm-hmm. It's a process. Yeah. It's not a phone call or a in-person conference. It's a process. It's some time. Yeah.
It takes a long time to build up that trust, and not very, yeah. And you can knock it down pretty quickly, right?
Yeah. And we see this most often when it comes to addiction, and of course it can work either way, whether it's a parent or the adult child, or the adolescent child for that matter, you know, who has battled addiction, has perhaps been in and out of rehabs, always, you know, we're wanting to return to the bosom of the family. Again, whether it be a parent or an adult child of that parent. And of course, it's quite understandable that people would be skeptical, because there've been slips and falls in the past. But do you just try to proceed cautiously and yet hopefully?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So also thinking, I think, Jonathan, you mentioned, you know, grandparents not being able to see their grandkids. And again, there could be a whole lot of reasons why somebody would do that. And I'm thinking, you know, somebody who might not have been the best parent, and I'm not saying, like, you know, somebody who was, you know, sexually assaulting or, you know, really traumatic stuff, but maybe they, you know, were a little neglectful or, you know, verbally abusive or something. Sometimes that parent isn't such a bad grandparent, right? Mm. And so, yeah. You know, you're basing it on your experience growing up with this parent, but it may not. I guess, Mark, it comes back to your idea of perception. So what is it you think, you know, a parent who's thinking, well, I don't know, they weren't the best parent to me, I don't know if I want that influence on the grandchildren. What is it they should look for that might make them change their mind to say, you know what, maybe supervised, you're with them when they have the kids to begin with, or you look for that behavior. Yeah. What are some of the things you would want to think about?
Well, that would be certainly a foremost, because you don't want, you know, your situation being repeated. And a lot of times, like you said, the grandparents are one generation removed, and they're not directly responsible for the child. which is very stressful. It's very stressful to be a parent and be directly responsible for someone. And sometimes they're in a situation where they're doing the best they can, but they still can't provide what they want, what the kids want, or what they want to, want to provide. So it's a no-win situation, but there's stress all around, and it depends on how you handle it. Again, perception.
Yeah.
Can you accept the stress for it's part of living, nobody's perfect. So you do the best you can. But and the parent in that scenario, the ones that get back in, maybe he didn't do the best that he could have. Mm-hmm. The parent of the young generation has to be a parent and protect them as a parent would. So
I think also on a practical level, daycare is so expensive now that if you can, as a parent of a very young child, if you can possibly justify allowing your parent back into your life for the sake of looking after your child a couple of days a week or whatever it may be. I mean, the economics of it, I hate to sound like there's anything to consider other than the psychological factors, but the reality is that people are paying a full week's wage just to provide daycare for their child. And if a grandparent is available to do that at no cost, that can be pretty compelling, even if there's been a very rocky history.
Yeah. And also, too, I was just thinking, I'm one of 10 children, so and I'm the oldest. And my father, I watch how my father, his parenting was very different with each of us. The punishments, the how he dealt with us, he was, I think, very different with me than he was with, say, the youngest, right? Kind of his old school, you train the oldest and the oldest kind of trains the younger ones. But it's interesting. I mean, it's one of the things you might want to have a conversation, again, kind of talking about, what your perception is and what your expectations are for the grandchildren, right?
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah.
We're talking about family estrangement this morning, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org, and we'll talk more after a break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking about family estrangement this morning with psychiatrist Mark Whaley and psychiatrist Jonathan Schwartz. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to join our conversation. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. So sometimes, as we're saying, it makes sense to cut off a family member forever. It's just toxic, for your own sanity and mental health, you need to do this. That can be a lonely place, right? You're mm-hmm. thinking, this is a person that you love, but you just, for whatever reason, you can't deal with. So I think, and you sort of touched on this, Jonathan, your family doesn't necessarily have to be biological, right? Like you talked about the family you marry into. It could also be just the people you put around you who you might not be related to biologically, but they are your support system, in sense, your family, right?
It's interesting you bring that up. Several years ago, I experienced a friendectomy. I had a friend that I used to have breakfast with almost every single Sunday at a local restaurant. And we certainly had a lot in common, and we went to ball games and enjoyed each other's company. And over the years, I became more and more uncomfortable around this person. The breakup, it's funny because I referred to breaking up with a friend, which is kind of weird. But it was around politics. You might not be so surprised to hear at the time of Trump's first campaign. And I just felt like I was uncomfortable being in the presence of this person. Mm. And I put off having the conversation because I really didn't know quite how do you have a conversation with, it wasn't like a romance or anything. It was a friendship, and but we broke up, and I explained that just couldn't be around him anymore. It was so weird.
Could you
Well,
have
that.
could you have just said we can't talk about politics, or was it that wasn't going to work?
But it was so much about what he stood for.
Oh,
You
okay, yeah, much
know, it
more than
wasn't
that.
just about the facts of politics.
You found that toxic. You experienced it as toxic, and well, the best step is protections, is boundary.
Yeah, it's funny. The 99-year-old uncle who I've talked about many times, he and his business partner, who was much younger than him, they had like a, my uncle never had any children, so he was like a son to him, and they formed this business partnership, and they were on completely opposite sides of the political spectrum. And he called it, he goes, "We almost got divorced over that," but they agreed to disagree and, you know, and just not talk politics. So that worked for them. But yeah, it's you know, who you surround yourself with, and you can find support in people that are not your biological relatives, is I guess what I'm trying to say. But I think there's also situations where, you know, you may have a difficult relationship with a parent, and you have an aunt or an uncle who are sympathetic to, they see those same things in their sibling, and they're sympathetic to what you're going through, right? And that can be a good form of support, right?
Definitely, yeah, definitely. It's somebody else in the family who perceives what's really going on, and don't aren't blinded by their own self-interest of some sort. Yeah, that's a great support, and also a great support to the person, because they have a history with the quote-unquote offender. It's nice to have an ally, really, with this, which does raise the question. Sometimes in therapy, the psychotherapist is manipulated to choose a side, and can actually, if they want to continue working with the individual, they have to reinforce their perception, which might be distorted. Well, everybody's perception is always distorted to some degree, but it might be distorted. It might be feeding into the conflict as opposed to just being a victim of it. And then it's hard to encourage the patient, say in this setting, to take a look at their own behavior. Have they done anything that would feed into this somehow? Encourage it unconsciously. That's one of the tasks of a therapist, and it's a tough path to follow.
What are you contributing to this relationship? Right. Yeah, exactly.
Right,
That's a
but it's always a two-way. In fact, it's a two-way thing. But you only have one person in the room,
But I guess I would think that in a lot of ways that would be very helpful. You go, "Oh my God, I had no idea that I, you know, unconsciously was doing whatever X, Y, or Z." And that might be helpful again into getting back to that resolving whatever the conflict is, right?
This seems like a reasonable time to mention what may be one of the most famous and also enduring studies of human longevity and behavior. That's the Harvard study that started back in the, I think it started in maybe the 60s, and
I
has continued to follow people for the purpose of trying to understand risk factors and positive influences on people's health and longevity, mental as well as physical health. And at this point in time, there was a recent kind of meta-analysis of, and this is a study that's followed thousands of people. But the most recent kind of meta-analysis of the data concluded that the single most important factor in determining human longevity is the closeness of a network of friends and family that you have in your life. And that people, the less isolated you are, the longer you live. Now, obviously, there's any number of other factors that can be powerful in this regard, but that the one factor that seemed to stand out as most robust was having that social network.
Yeah, that makes sense, though, when you think about it. I mean, we're social creatures. Mark, you've talked about this many times. That's what, you know, we're meant to be social, right? Not not isolated, living out.
All the more reason to do whatever one can to salvage and reconcile when there is grief.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, so let's talk about that for a second. Let's talk about the grief. I wanted to, you know, you may be, you know, the person who's been cut off, and you may or may not understand why, but on either side, you're losing this relationship, right? So it is almost like a death in a way. So is it the same kind of grieving process that you would go through as if this person had died, or is the grief different?
It's very similar in terms of the emotional impact. It might be different in facts, it's very similar. And actually, it hurts a little bit more because the person's still alive. And if only they could see it my way, we would undo this death, which, you know, is impossible otherwise, in a real death. It hurts even more because it's possible to rise from the grave in this setting. It's because of the quote unquote, the willfulness of the individual that cut me out, that is causing this pain. Frequently people can't see beyond that. And it hurts, and it will shorten their life, their own life, because of the distress that is has its physiological detriment, physiological tolls.
So grief counseling would be a thing to think about, right? Going through some grief counseling as you would if someone died. What about the thought of the repeated rejection? You know, you want to resolve this and you keep reaching out, and this, after a while, the repeated rejection, not only is it going to add to the grief, but I would think sometimes it could lead to a little bit of anger. Oh, why won't they talk to me about this, right? Especially for the ones that I don't understand why, or, you know, I can't see the grandkids. There's a lot of emotions that go along with this.
Yeah, absolutely. And that usually, when you feel that, and this is true in many other contexts as well, what it also is telling you is something about the anger that the other person feels, because they're, you know, it's not coincidence that they're stirring up feelings of anger in you, because they've been angry with you this whole time too.
Yeah. Which again can also lead to depression, right? And Jonathan, that's in your lane. So somebody who's got, like, who's just, you know, had this repeated feeling grief, feeling, you know, the anger, and now feeling just totally depressed about it. You know, what do we do about that? How do you treat that? Is that a temporary depression? Can it lead to like clinical depression? You know, what does that road look like, or could look like?
Well, I mean, we know that when there is a source of a depression, like a family breakup, or chronic pain is just another example of a cause for depression. That no matter what treatment you might throw at it, whether it's medications, TMS, cognitive behavioral therapy, whatever you might have, if that source, the origin of the pain or sadness or upset remains in place, there's no treatment that is going to be a cure, or really have a lasting benefit. Until you can somehow tackle the cause of it or make it go away. So, for example, you know, when people come to us for TMS, and the source of their depression is a hostile workplace and an abusive boss, you know, I try to coach them to make sure that they're getting counseling on how they can address that problem. If they have chronic pain from let's say a slipped disc or some such thing as that. Again, that really ultimately is going to need to be addressed, or they're going to be back seeing me in 6 months or whatever, looking for another course of treatment, right?
Yeah. So for folks, TMS, what's that? go ahead and tell folks, you know, what that is. Because I'm sure people are going to go, what is that, right?
I wasn't really looking for an invitation.
No, I know, but that's okay. We have a few minutes to talk about it, so go ahead.
So you know, the world now has a way of treating depression and anxiety and OCD with magnetic energy. This is a treatment that is now available in four different places on the Cape. I have two of those four. And it is an incredibly safe treatment that has a higher batting average than any, more than twice as high a batting average as any medication ever prescribed for depression or OCD. So I'll leave it at that.
Well, but you have to have tried many things before you can get insurance to pay for TMS, right?
Actually, now if you have Medicare, which many people do, you only have to have tried one medicine.
Oh.
Some insurance companies now are heading in that direction. They are loosening up their requirements. Some people, if they have one of the state plans, they may have failed on four medicines. But even the state Medicaid, you know, mass health type plans are now paying for people to have this transcranial stimulation.
Mm. That's good to know. All right. So in the last few minutes that we have, let's talk a little bit about how sort of healing steps, if you will. We talked about if you can, right, you want to try to talk it out, reconcile. Maybe we'd talk family therapy, maybe doing some family therapy, because, mm-hmm. again, Mark, you talked about this. It's perception. And one mm-hmm. side might not really understand what the other side is seeing, and vice versa, sure. right? Maybe family therapy would be a step.
Then if there's some ground rules, and if people both want it and accept it, if one is twisted to their arms twisted to come, that's not going to work. Mm-hmm. But if they're willing to accept really taking a look at themselves, which is really what it requires as opposed to a blaming stance. Mm-hmm. It could be very powerful, and it can be done, you know, with an individual who knows about these things and can kind of help elicit where the distortions are in their perceptions. So, right.
And if they're not willing, it's not a bad idea. I mean, if you're really struggling with it, to just go to therapy yourself, right?
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, usually it would help if the individuals approached therapy themselves before they try to do it together. Mm-hmm. I think family therapists would probably agree with that that model.
Right. And you want to try to build boundaries, right? Or set mm-hmm. boundaries. Mm-hmm. Also, and just, I guess, being aware of your own self-care. Sometimes you got to, as we said earlier, you got to do what you got to do, right?
Absolutely, for yourself. By the way, there's one scenario that we kind of left out this morning, and that is rejection or exclusion in a family because of sexual orientation right. or identity.
Yeah.
And that's really a ripe one parentectomy or something like that.
Yeah. That can be so tough. Yeah.
Oh, and the wounds last.
And again, you know, one parent, supporting and one not. I mean, it just, a terrible situation. All right. Psychiatrist Mark Whaley and psychiatrist Jonathan Schwartz join us the third Wednesday of the month to talk about mental health issues. Thank you so much for your insight this morning. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.